I will tell you that when I met her, we had dinner together, and what you're supposed to do when you never heard anyone speak, you go out and talk to them during dinner and get to know some things about them. I had her sitting on one side and John Tesh and Steve on the other. I said, "My name's Jimmy." She said, "My name's Tina." An hour and a half later, I said, "Well, thank you. Good to meet you." They... Thirty-two years ago, I chaired the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was chaired at Star Mountain Greensboro, and the man that was the old timer that was heading it up said, "You need to call and get a speaker." And I said, "I don't know anybody. Who's supposed to call?" She said, "Call Jay Plumback." I said, "What if he says no and I'll have to hate him the rest of his life?" He said, "He won't." So I called Jay and he instantly said yes, and he did that for the next 31 years, one time a year, twice a year sometime. But that's not what impressed me the most about Jay. What impressed me the most, I've been to a lot of AA conferences in my days, and the best speakers are always here. And I wondered how he did it, and he had the knack to get the best speakers in the world, in my opinion. And tonight we got one too today. Tina's a lovely lady. She's from Southern California. She's from the hotbed of speakers, and I can't wait to hear her. Tina, come on up, love. I love you, darling.
Thanks, honey.
Thank you.
Hi, you guys. My name's Tina Albert, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really grateful to be here and to be sober this morning. And if anyone is new or relatively new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I really want to welcome you here. I'm like, this has been sitting here all weekend, and all the speakers have been referencing it, and Jay's looking at me, and I'm like, I just want to turn it over because I'm not supposed to cry till I'm done. There's not a lot of speakers in Alcoholics Anonymous that make me cry other than myself, but I loved Jay and Randy's little introduction and what he was saying about him this morning, like, got me choked up before I even start, which is not a good idea because I'll be slinging snot all over the front row for the next 2 hours and 15 minutes, so buckle up. You guys, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and if Jay were here, I would tell him thank you so much for having me come and share with you guys this morning. He was my friend, and my sobriety date is October 10th, 1984. I've been sober for 28 years and 11 months, and I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was thinking this morning, I always think about, like, the talk I'm going to give, and I come up with really nifty stuff that never flies out of my mouth. But what I was thinking about this morning was when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous on the 10th day of October in 1984, I was one of those ones in the big book that talks about being tortured by loneliness. And I had absolutely destroyed every single relationship that mattered to me in my life, and I came in here completely alone. And the belief that I had was that all the relationships that I had in my life, you guys, it was always your fault, like Frank was talking about, you guys had abandoned me and left me alone and done me wrong. And I came in here with like this stone wall around my heart and nobody could get in. And I was so lonely, you guys, when I got here. And the greatest gift that I've had in Alcoholics Anonymous and in 28 years of sobriety is to form relationships in my life that are unique and priceless. And Jay was one of those relationships. He would fly into Los Angeles and I would tell him, I'm going to cuss one time from the podium. I would tell him, I'm your bitch. And I would pick him up from the airport and take him to lunch at the Mission and take him back to the hotel and get him for the meeting and take him home afterwards. And I loved being Jay's taxi service. And one trip he brought Ara and I got to meet Ara, and that was a great joy. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys, and in my opinion, what that means is that the things that I love in my life, I serve. And I hope that's always the case, and I hope that my actions show my love for Alcoholics Anonymous and for the people in my life more than my words do. Goodness gracious. You guys, I hate speaking on Sunday morning. Every single time I'm asked to come to one of these things, y'all always put me on Sunday morning, and I giggle and wonder how come. And then I think perhaps you meant to call like Tammy P from the Valley, not Tina A from LA. And I always say that. They go Sunday, and I go, no, you guys, I'm Tina. Like, wrong speaker. Because I suppose I'm supposed to be spiritual or something, and I'm not one of those, like, send you home with the love of Jesus speakers from Sunday morning. I am a hot mess, you guys. I'm 28 years sober, and I'm a crier, and I sling snot, and I always think I'm not supposed to do that, and it happens anyway. It just really makes me mad, and I just show up because that's what you guys taught me how to do. So, Jay, thank you for having me come, and thank you for your friendship. And I talked to him a couple weeks ago, and the last thing that he said to me was, I love you, kid. And that, like, says it all, and his action showed me that, too. It wasn't that he had to say it. Like, I know that he loved me. So enough of this happy crap. To the committee, thank you so much for having me come and share with you guys this weekend. I've had an awesome weekend. Like, Frank told me I'm a golf whore, beats the alternative. And that's spiritual growth, in my opinion. I'm a new golf convert. I've been golfing for about 6 months, and I am, like, obsessed. So I've played 2 rounds, and I'm probably going to do another one this afternoon, and one more in the morning before I leave. But I've had an awesome weekend, and the thing that I love the most about Alcoholics Anonymous, like I said, is the relationships that I get to form. And so it's been awesome to come here and spend the weekend with Frank and some people. Well, Frank's the only people I know, but he counts for a bunch of them. So it's been really cool to spend the weekend with him and to meet some new friends. And I hope you guys have had a good time, too, this weekend. I know it takes a lot of work to put these things on. And so to the one-man band who did so much before he left, and to the people that are going to carry on next year, thank you guys for your efforts. So I get to share with you guys in a general way what I used to be like and what happened and what I'm like today, or more specifically what I'd like you to think I'm like today is probably what I'm going to share. But I, you guys, needed a drink long before I ever took one. I was restless, irritable, and discontented, like our big book talks about, from the time that I could remember. I was raised in a little Southern California beach community called Manhattan Beach, and I remember as a little girl, I swear to God, sitting around the dinner table with my brothers and sisters, knowing that my mom loved them way more than she loved me, and I'm an only child, so... gives you a little insight into, like, my thought process long before I ever picked up a drink, from the time that I could remember. Like, I wasn't much, but I was all that I thought about. And not only was I consumed with myself, but I was wondering how consumed you were with me, too. And, like, it's been like the Tina show from the time that I could remember. So I'm from West Virginia, so if I start twanging and talking about Pittsburgh before I leave here, you'll know how come. But we transplanted to the West Coast when I was a little girl, and I was raised in Manhattan Beach. It's this little upper-middle-class beach community, and all the girls that I went to school with were, like, 5 foot tall, and they all had long, flowing blonde hair and these sparkling blue eyes and these bitchin' little surfer chick tans. They looked like little prepubescent Pamela Andersons. I swear to God, they were just absolutely perfect. And I went to school when I was in the 7th grade. I was 5'8". I had long, stringy, reddish hair, buck teeth, and freckles. And I felt like Pippi Longstocking on crack. I was just odd. From the time that I could remember, I felt separate and different and not good enough and not smart enough and not pretty enough. I thought you guys had the manual to life and you just knew how to do these things and have these relationships and interact with each other. And I felt like I was on the outside of the bubble looking in, and I didn't know how to connect with other people. And it was that way from the time that I could remember. And Paul talked last night about the only color he got was from the light in the refrigerator. Thanks for your talk, you guys. Mitzi did an awesome job before I forget on whatever the heck day we got here. and Frank on Friday and Paul on Saturday. I've loved listening to the speakers and sharing the podium with you guys. But he talked about the only color he got coming from the light in the refrigerator, and I was one of those kids that would walk out during a full moon and get a third-degree sunburn. I mean, I was just like sickly white, and I had this stringy hair and these big old teeth, and I was too tall, and I was too skinny, and everything was wrong with me, you guys. And I remember going to gym class in the seventh grade, and where we had to start doing our PE class and then showering after PE, like that was a nightmare. And all these little girls had these little lacy training bras and these little matching undies, and my training bra fit better when I put it on backwards. I was just so odd, you guys. And I was in the seventh grade. My best friend's name was Carrie, and she was Italian. I loved Carrie because her teeth were bigger than mine were. I've been seeking lower companions for my whole life. And and she decided one day we were going to cut school, we were going to go to her house, and we were going to drink. And I didn't have anybody in my life that I could look at and see the effects that they got from a drink of alcohol. So I had no idea, but we cut school, we went to her house, we cracked a fifth of scotch, and my drinking career was like, could have been written that day. I drank straight out of the bottle. We didn't have any glass, any ice, any mixers. It was like nasty, vile, horrible, rotten stuff, and it burned all the way down, and it burned all the way up, and it burnt when it flew out my nose. It was just putrid. Any scotch drinkers in here? I know why you guys are in AA. My goodness, that is vile. And I remember like little tiny bits and pieces of that day. Like I drank entirely too much scotch. I spray puked all over Carrie's living room. I had a blackout, which I didn't know at the time, but phaser's on stun. Now I forgot where I was, and I'm going to have to start all over again. My name's Tina Albert, and I'm an alcoholic. So I spray puked all over Carrie's living room, and I had large gaps in my memory bank that afternoon. The school had called because we were cutting, and my mom came to Carrie's house right after lunch to find me. I don't know how come she knew where I was, but she came, and we jumped out Carrie's bedroom window, and I was off on Pippi's first grand adventure, you guys. I had so much fun that afternoon. I was a little buzzed from the scotch. I remember climbing the water tower in Manhattan Beach. I remember jumping over backyard fences and hiding in doghouses, and I was running from the cops, and they weren't even chasing me. It was just like so much fun, you guys. And about 4 o'clock that afternoon, I knew I couldn't go home because I was in trouble. So we went back to Carrie's house. I had stolen a bicycle with no seat on it from the continuation school. And I forgot to mention during this particular phase in my development, I was doing the Pippi Goes Lowrider phase. So I had this reddish hair all like pitchforked on the Aquanet hairspray. And I was wearing Dickie pants and a little collared shirt. And I was running all over Redondo Beach scribbling La Flaca R13 all over the walls in pencil. And I made tagging cool. I'm like a trendsetter. And I had stolen this bicycle, and I decided that the answer to the dilemma that I found myself in was to run away from home because I couldn't go home. I was in trouble. And I took Carrie's 9-year-old brother. I put him on the handlebars of the bicycle, and we ran away from home because it just seemed like the answer. And so I drank too much. I got drunk. I threw up. I had a blackout. I got in trouble. I got somebody else in trouble right along with me because I'm not one of those get in trouble by yourself kind of girls. And I want somebody else to take half the heat off me. And we ran away from home. I got all the way up to East L.A. with a chain around my neck and a butcher knife I had stolen from the kitchen for protection. And Sean started crying. I was like 12 years old. I had no answers left, and I called the police for the first and only time in my life on myself, and they came and picked us up, and my mom was mortified. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would tell anybody that would listen, which weren't too many people, it's my life, and I'm going to do whatever I want. And my drinking really never affected anybody but me. Like, I hurt myself way more than I hurt anybody else. And I could tell you guys, if anybody says that to you, run from them. Run from them, because they do not have your best interest at heart. I got a sponsor who started poking holes in that story right away, which saved my life, you guys. But I destroyed my mom that day. She came to the police station at 11 o'clock that night and picked me up. She was crying. She couldn't even drive, and her friend was cussing and smacking at me in the back seat. And I felt so bad. She was like, how could you do this? And I'm crying. I'm going like, I don't know, Mommy, I don't know. And the next morning, I woke up with a horrible hangover. I had thrown up in my bed, which was par for the course, really. And somebody needed to snatch me up and explain to me why I shouldn't do that every single day for the rest of my life. You guys, I loved the effect that I got from that drink of alcohol. Like the first, second, or third drink that stayed down, something absolutely phenomenal happened to me. Like, I swear to God, in that moment, my hair straightened and my teeth shrunk and my boobs grew and everything that was broken about me just seemed to melt into the background. And today what I know happened to me was that for the very first time in my life, I absolutely didn't care what somebody else thought about me. And in our big book, in the doctor's opinion, it talks about men and women drinking essentially because they like the effect that's produced by alcohol. And I personally think that's a no-brainer. But if you bear with me, it goes on to say that while we admit that we know this is injurious, we can't after a time differentiate from the true from the false. And our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. You guys, I drank for 8 years, and by the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was like, stick a fork in me, I'm done. I destroyed absolutely everything that I loved for a drink of alcohol. I got that sense of ease and comfort that Dr. Silkworth says comes at once by taking a few drinks, and that happened to me the very first time. And my sponsor talks a lot about if alcohol doesn't do something to you, it'll never, ever do something for you. And from the time that I could remember, it did something to me that was so phenomenal that I was willing to trade everything that I loved in my life and everything that you loved in your life, too, for just another 5 or 10 or 15 minutes of ease and comfort that came at once by me taking a few drinks. And the funny thing is, really quickly in my drinking career, I realized that I was going to take a drink of alcohol, I was going to get an effect that was produced from it, and in a minute, I was going to be in a lot of trouble, and I was going to hurt the people that I loved, and I was going to trade the things that mattered to me, and I didn't even care. Like in Alcoholics Anonymous, you hear people say all the time that insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results, and you guys personally, like, I think insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, knowing exactly what's going to happen to you when you make that conscious decision sober to pick up another drink because you need that sense of ease and comfort. And I drank myself into and out of middle school, high school, continuation school. When I was 17 years old, I took the California High School Proficiency Exam. I graduated from high school early because I had no credits, and I was working at Burger King one day, and I love men in uniform. Ladies, anybody else? Come on, put your hands up, you liars. Cub Scouts, football players, doesn't matter to me. I just love me a man in uniform. And I was working at Burger King, and I was drunk and loaded from hanging out the drive-thru window, and I turned around, and there was a United States Marine standing at the cash register in his dress blue uniform, and there was no uniform like that one, I swear to God. And I intuitively knew that I wanted what he had, and I was willing to go to any lengths to get it. I lived by that principle long before you guys came up with that silly idea, and I gave him my phone number, and he started calling me. I was so surprised, you guys, at crazy hours, like 10 and 11 o'clock in the morning. I had just crawled in the house, or I wasn't up yet, and I finally went down to his office to see what I wanted, and I found out that he was a United States Marine Corps recruiter. And if you don't know this, their sole intent is to recruit you into the United States Marine Corps. And so I spun this sad tale of woe about why I was a 17-year-old with a proficiency certificate working at Burger King. I told him that that my father had left and I had to go to work to supplement my poor mother's income so she didn't lose her house. And I could tell all the Al-Anons in the room when I tell that story because your butt puckers. You could almost, like, it's audible. Like, She still hates me for that. She is totally an Al-Anonic, and I can't get her to go to a meeting to save my life. But I spun this sad tale of woe, and I found out really quickly that Sergeant Dale Starkey had no intention whatsoever of recruiting me into his United States Marine Corps. So he took me next door to the Navy office. And in 1981, you guys, I got off this bus in Orlando, Florida, and I was lining up on these little yellow footprints and running over here, and they were taking my stuff and screaming in my face, and I was 17 years old, the youngest person in my company, and I realized that a really big mistake had been made. And in the morning, as soon as I could speak to somebody in charge, because I'm kind of a quick thinker and I talk fast, I can talk my way out of just about anything, I thought I would be able to explain the nature of the mistake that they had made, and they would send me home. And Navy boot camp doesn't work like that, and I was in trouble all the way through Navy boot camp. And if you've never been, what that means is you were in trouble all the way through Navy boot camp, too. And it always proceeded with my last name and you doing push-ups. And so I didn't have a lot of friends in Navy boot camp. I got in trouble 5 weeks into my military career. Somebody brought a six-pack of beer into the chow hall when I was working there. We have a work week 5 weeks in. I drank the six-pack. I met the commanding officer of the recruit facility in Orlando, Florida. I had what's known as a captain's mast. It's like court for you Navy non-military people. I was in trouble, and I thought they were going to kick me out, and he took pity on me. He sent me to a division sidewalk, rifle training, ugly, 12 hours of sweat and puke, and then I graduated with my company. And they sent me to A school in Pensacola, Florida, where I had my second captain's mast. I met my second commanding officer for drinking on duty, leaving base on a duty weekend, wearing civilian clothes when I was supposed to be in my uniform, blah, blah, blah. And this time they took a stripe, half my pay for a month, and they put me in the restricted barracks for 14 days. And I thought they were going to kick me out. They sent me to NASAP, which is Navy Alcohol Safety Awareness Program. I'm 17 years old. I have my first encounter with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm thinking, like, really, you guys? Like, I heard this song when I was a kid, What Do You Do With a Drunken Sailor? And so I thought, like, that was, how's my singing, Paul? It was good, huh? I thought it was part of my job description, really, I did. And so I was in trouble. I did 14 days in the restricted barracks. I got set back into the class after mine and graduated. And the problem was that they had enlisted me to be in naval intelligence. I was a cryptologic technician. And so when I was in the restricted barracks, all of these top secret special intelligence security clearances are coming through so I could do my job. And they sent me off to my first duty station, which was Adak, Alaska. And it's this little ice-covered rock off the Kamchatka Strait in Russia. And in 1981 and 1982, we were spying on Russia. So that's where they sent people in naval intelligence. And you guys, I was secretary to the commanding officer of the Naval Security Group on ADAC. And I went to work every morning. I was 17 years old. I wore my dress uniform. My hair was perfect. My creases were so sharp they'd cut your fingers. And my shoes were so shiny, like from across the room, they'd blind you. I mean, like, I was a sight to behold. And I absolutely loved serving my country, you guys. I said in the beginning of my talk that I believe what it means to love means to serve. And I love my country. I love being a sailor. I loved working for my commanding officer. The only problem was by this time I had found, like, the morning drink, like one of our other speakers had spoken about, Frank. And I would get up every single morning and I would reach to the nightstand and drink Jack Daniels straight out of the bottle just to, like, calm myself, and I'd crack a beer and get in the shower and get ready for work. And at noon I would go to the EM club and I would drink a couple Long Island iced teas, and then I would go back to work and I would start sending classified information all over the country to the wrong people at the wrong commands, and they don't like that. I remember I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys, and I was telling my sponsor, because I was, like, victimized by people leaving me. I was telling my first sponsor, like, I cannot believe they kicked me out of the Navy. They just threw me away like a piece of used garbage. And Paul goes, what do you mean they just threw you away, didn't give you another chance? You were a threat to national security, for crying out loud. And I didn't see it like that. You old-timers have just a funky spin on the way that you perceive things. But I was drinking all the time, you guys. This time they're sending me to Exo's Mast because I'm working for the commanding officer. They sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous. They put me on Anabuse. I was going to the cat counselor, and I'm taking this Anabuse. I'm drinking on Anabuse. I'm sick all the time. And if you've never done that, I highly suggest that you skip it. The first time I got to think, and I could probably pull it off, and I drank half a Heineken, I threw up for, I swear to God, 6 solid hours. And I was in the bathroom with my face against the cold porcelain. I had this big splotchy rash all over myself when I woke up the next morning and tried to pass it off for chicken pox. I was, like, so sick. And I'm taking this Anabuse, and about 3 weeks later, I thought, I've been taking this for a little while, and I'm certain my body's probably acclimated to it by now. And perhaps if I had, like, a Coors Light, because that's almost water anyway, I would be able to, like, get away with it this time. And I went over to the EM club, and the bartender was one of the guys in the AA meetings that they were making me go to. And I said, because I thought, like, when I drank that half a Heineken, I didn't even get a buzz. So maybe if I had a drink of Jack Daniels and then the beer, I would at least get a buzz in case I threw up. And so I took a double shot of Jack Daniels. Bill gave it to me, stepped back and put his arms across his chest and looked at me like 3 steps back on the cooler, because you guys in AA are smart. And I took the drink of Jack Daniels. I fell off the stool and had an alcoholic seizure and woke up in the emergency room. They sent me to the psych unit in Anchorage and left me in there for 3 weeks. So it was supposed to be a 72-hour observation, and I left there fully observed, I can assure you, with a recommendation that I be separated from the United States Navy, and I was devastated, you guys. They gave me all kinds of funky diagnoses, like manic depressive bipolar with a personality disorder and passive aggressive blah blah blah, but nobody ever once said, like, alcoholic. And I went back to my command with that recommendation to be separated, and I asked Captain Shivik to help me, and he sent me to rehab in Philadelphia. And I went to rehab in Philly. I got there, and 3 weeks in, we went to a Phillies game for a little Sunday field trip, and I tried that grand experiment one more time. I drank a half a beer from Philly Stadium, spray puked 5 rows, and I was discharged from the United States Navy on the 15th of July in 1983. And I swear to God, you guys, I've made a lot of amends in Alcoholics Anonymous, but that was the one thing for like 1,000 years that I thought that I was never going to be able to rectify. And I gave him my eldest born to make up for it, and it seemed to work all right. I was discharged from the Navy from that rehab, and my counselor was standing at the quarterdeck when I left there, and he asked me for my post-rehab plan, because if you guys have ever been to rehab, you know you got to have one of those. And I told him that I was going to go to the neighborhood Alano Club in downtown Philly. I was going to ask this nasty, cantankerous old bat named Alice to be my sponsor, because I knew you needed one of those. I had been listening in AA. And she was one of those chain-smoking old witches that used to talk like this, like all my favorite old-timer women in AA used to do. You don't talk like that, do you? Is that why he's leaving? Okay. Did it again. My name's Tina Albert, and I'm an alcoholic. But I swear to God, you guys, that day you could have put my hand on a stack of Bibles, and I would have sworn to you that I was going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was not going to drink anymore. I was going to pull the, like, the smoldering ruins of my career out of the fire and do whatever it took to not drink. I was, like, committed with every fiber of my being. I didn't want to drink, and I wanted to do the right thing. And I told him that's what I was going to do, and Jim was an old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous. He goes, kid, if you ever want to get sober, call Alcoholics Anonymous, but you won't, you'll die drunk. And I was 18 years old at that time, and 19 years old when I was discharged, and I left that rehab. I went over to the Philly Naval Station to wait for my separation, and by noon I was at the EM Club pitching quarters and drinking beer and throwing up on Anabuse for the fourth time. And I'm that one in the Big Book where it talks about being unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of a week or a month ago, and being without defense against that first drink. And for the next bunches of months, from July of 83 to October of 1984. I did every nasty, rotten, horrible, messed up thing that I swore to God I would never do that separated me from you. When I left that rehab, I went, can't be an alcoholic. I've never had a 502, drunk driving, whatever you call them now. Never been to jail. I've not lost any families. I haven't lost my kids to CPS. I haven't lost any jobs. Like, I don't know what I thought the United States Navy was. It's not just a job. It's an adventure, right? And I thought, I can't be like you. And I'd been to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had heard that language of the heart that you guys share, and things had like penetrated that steel armor that surrounded me, but I could not fathom the idea of going the rest of my life without a drink. Like, you guys said that that was the answer, and it wasn't the one that I was looking for. In California, I don't know if y'all do it back here, in California you guys talk all the time about just don't drink no matter what. And I think, like, that is the most ridiculous crap I have ever heard in my life, because I drink no matter what. And when you guys go just don't drink no matter what, like, I know that you don't understand the nature of my problem. I need a drink. Like, when for the longest time in my life, people used to tell me you have a problem with alcohol, and I absolutely know that they don't understand, because my problem is not with alcohol. I have problems with consequences in my life as a result of drinking alcohol. That I'm certain of. But something happens to me when I'm about 72 hours away from my last drink. I find myself stark raving sober. And that happens sometimes, you guys, at like 28 years of sobriety. I'll walk into my home group and somebody will go, how you doing, Tina? And I'll be like, what do you mean? Like, what do you mean, how you doing, Tina? Yesterday it was, hey, honey. And this morning it's, how you doing, Tina? Like, really? I don't know what I did to you to offend you like that, but you would speak to me like that. But I don't think right, you guys. I don't think right. If I'm not in meetings on a regular basis, I don't act right. And I'm just not right. That's just really the truth of the matter. But I forgot where I was again. Doggone it. Where was I? 72 hours, I love you, somebody's listening, 72 hours away from my last drink, I can't stand the way that I think, I can't stand the way that I feel, I like burn with this guilt and this shame and this remorse from the things that I have done, the things that I have lost in my life that absolutely require me to take a drink. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous finally thinking, like, maybe I'm going to surrender to you guys, for a little while. And so during that last 15 months of my drinking, I did everything I swore I would never do that separated me from you, and I lost everything that I loved in my life. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous weighing 120 sucked up pounds, and I'm 5'10", so I was a little skinny, and I had just enough bile in my hair to pass as highlights, and I had a this stinky shirt that I hadn't washed in forever and a pair of way too tight jeans with a big hole right in the back end. So when I walked into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, all the old-timer men went like this. Which was perfect, because it meant you weren't going to look me in the face, because you guys looked me in the face and made eye contact with me, and the first thing that I had to do was this. Like, I could not stand making eye contact with people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I felt like when you guys looked me in the eye, you could see all the way down into, like, the pit of my soul, and you could see that black ugliness. That was me. And, oh, my God, I was so broken when I came here. I was living in a really bitchin' townhouse. It was really like a roundabout townhouse, because when it wasn't broken down, it got me roundabout town. It was a 1971 MG Midget. And I had a trunk in the trunk with all my dirty, nasty belongings in it. And I had absolutely no relationships left in my life, you guys. My mom had kicked me out about 6 months prior and told me that her only daughter was dead and that I was never to come back to her house again. And I'm her only child. I can only imagine, like, the heartbreak that I caused that woman for her to do that to me. I was like the sunshine in her life. It, like, rose and set on me. She used to tell me, bend over and let me kiss your butt so we can get on with the day. And I was so spoiled, you guys. And she told me, get out of my house and never come back. My only daughter's dead. And I left, and I was living in that car, and I was, I had that loneliness that so few people do. Our big book says that we know loneliness such as so few people do. And I was like devastated. I had traded everything that I loved for the sense of ease and comfort that I got from a drink. And I think on the 10th day of October in 1984, I worked the best first, second, and third step that I've ever worked in Alcoholics Anonymous in 28 years and 11 months. I went into the Boys Market in Southern California. I'd stolen a 1.75 liter bottle of cheap vodka, and I had it sitting in my den. And I I hadn't even cracked the seal on the bottle and taken a drink yet, and my shoulders dropped a couple inches, and that, like, insane crick in my neck went away, and I was able to take a nice, long, deep breath. And I suppose, from what I understand anyway, most folks are supposed to ingest the alcohol before they get that effect. But I just knew, like, in a minute, whenever I made that decision to take that drink, everything was going to be okay for a minute. And the vodka was sitting in the seat next to me. And just like he was sitting there, I heard that counselor at my rehab say, kid, if you ever want to get sober, call Alcoholics Anonymous, but you won't. You'll die drunk. And to the very core of my being, I realized that I was an alcoholic, that I was absolutely powerless over alcohol, that my life was completely unmanageable, that I was broken. I didn't drink like anybody else that I knew. And everybody that I loved, even people that drank and got loaded like monsters, were telling me, like, you just need to go away. You can't come here anymore. And I, Bill Wilson talks about booze being his master. And, oh, my God, I, like, know that feeling. And I was 20 years old, and like our big book says that we have to concede to our innermost self that we're real alcoholics, and this is the first step in our recovery. And to the core of my being, I knew that I was an alcoholic. And I didn't remember too much your steps, and I hadn't really read your literature, but I had been to your meetings, and I knew, like, the second step had something to do with God. And step two says that we come to believe that there's some sort of power greater than ourselves that's going to restore us to sanity. And I certainly didn't think that there was a God in my life anymore. I would tell you guys, for 10 years sober, that I was agnostic, because it's my belief today that the minute I acknowledge the presence of a loving Father in my life, it is incumbent upon me to turn my will and my life over to the care of that power. So for 10 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I went, there's no God. Like, I really believed, and if there was, like, whatever anyway, I don't want to acknowledge that, because then I'm going to have to start acting different. Really, who wants to do that? I didn't come in here to learn how to act different. I just came in here not to drink. And I, sitting in the car, I realized that maybe this power that might restore me to sanity where alcohol is concerned anyway might be the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of AA for a minute, just so that I could get a little bit of relief from the brokenness in my life. A lot of people say, like, steps 1, 2, and 3 are all about reflection, and the first action step in Alcoholics Anonymous is step 4. And you guys, I beg to differ. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says that we make a decision, which is like a reflection and a whatever. And then it says, and then we say something ridiculous like this, God, I offer myself to thee. So not only am I making decision in reflection, but I'm taking some sort of action and I'm saying some sort of prayer. And my third step action that day was to get out of the car and put a dime in the payphone. I know you guys don't remember those. There's these square boxes that used to hang on poles. I put a dime in the payphone. I called Alcoholics Anonymous like Jim told me to. I said, my name's Tina and I'm an alcoholic. And this little old man named Sam covered up the mouthpiece of the phone and he said to Eunice, who was our central office manager, we got a live one here, let's send her to Birch. And he sent me all the way across town to the Southwest Alano Club in Hawthorne, California. I walked into a Wednesday night 5:30 meeting. The topic was relationships, which was special. And there were about 70 people in there. They all ranged in age from like 86 to 132. They all had blue hair and no teeth and whatever, and they said something ridiculous to me like this. If you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. And I thought, really, if I want what you have, I will take it from you, and I'm certain I can outrun you. And I sat in that meeting, you guys, broken. I was absolutely broken. This lady came up to me and she gave me a big book that you guys gave me. And you had written all kinds of phone numbers in there of people that I wouldn't call to put me out if I were on fire. And I sat through that 5:30 meeting, and then I sat through the 8:30 meeting, and then you guys swooped me up and took me to something called fellowship. And you bought me a $1.99 breakfast and sat with me till 2 o'clock in the morning when I couldn't get any liquor because you had made me dump out my vodka. And I didn't have anywhere to go. I parked my car behind that Alano Club, and I moved there for the next 30 days. Much to your dismay, there's a chain up now. You can't get into the parking lot when the Alano Club's closed. It's the Tina chain or something. But I lived behind that Alano Club for 30 days, and the secretary of the 6:45 meeting bought me a toothbrush and some toothpaste, some soap. He would wake me up in the morning when he was making the coffee by banging on my window. And he would let me come in and drink all the coffee I wanted and eat all the donuts I wanted. And I'd wash up in the bathroom before all you guys got there to go to work. And you would come in at 6:45 for these little attitude adjustment meetings before you went to work at places like Northrop and TRW. So I would adjust your little attitudes, and then I would send you off to work. And then I'd go to the 11:30 meeting and the 5:30 meeting and the 8:30 meeting, and then we do the fellowship thing again. I'd drink coffee till 2 a.m. and vibrate in the car till 6, and Gary'd come wake me up. It was like this pathetic groundhog day, you guys, and every single day I woke up and thought, like, no! And then I would just do it again, and then I would just do it again. And you guys told me to keep coming back, which was kind of odd. I hadn't heard that in a long time, and I just kept coming back. And I realized not too long into this that what happened was you guys were so incredibly kind to me. Oh, my goodness. You guys loved me in a way that I could not fathom. Like, and that in and of itself had me keep coming back for a long time. I didn't come in here because I wanted to stay sober for the rest of my life, 24 hours at a time. Like, there was this old-timer used to get up to the podium named Tom Woods, and he would say, "You never have to pick up another drink for the rest of your life, 24 hours at a time." And I looked at him and thought, old man, you only have 3 days left. Like, it's going to be easy for you to never pick up another drink for the rest of your life, 24 hours at a time. I am 20 years old. I'm the president and founder of the Never Had a Legal Drink Club, for crying out loud. And I am certain, like, there are things that are going to happen in my life that are going to require me to have a drink. And I just want to, like, take the heat off. I just want to, like, find him and move out of my car and whatever. Like, fix the things that I had broken until I could drink until I was 86 years old and would come back and join you guys then. But I couldn't fathom the idea of not drinking, but I just kept coming because I didn't have anywhere else to go. And because you guys were so kind to me, you were so, so nice to me, I didn't even know how to handle it. And I'll tell you, the day that I was hooked on Alcoholics Anonymous, I had 6 weeks sober. And Birch had this annual old-timers meeting the Friday after Thanksgiving every year. They still do it. And everybody that shares at that meeting as an old-timer, they all have 20 years or more. And I showed up, and they would arrange them on the stage in their varying stages of decay. And my sponsor had, like, oxygen with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. And my friend Bob had no leg, and he was on a walker. He had, like, a prosthetic limb. And my mama Helen's missing her eyeball with a big old patch because she had lost her eye to cancer. And you guys did it again. This lady named Helen Louise got up to the podium. She was draped in a full-length mink coat, and she had all these diamonds. And she draped herself over the podium, and I swear to God, you guys, she looked right at me, and she said, "Wear your sobriety, honey." And I looked down at my little fishnets and hooker heels and thought, well, I am. I love the old-timers and Alcoholics Anonymous, especially the Al-Anon old-timers, because y'all gave me all of your daughter's clothing that was too offensive for your teenagers to wear. And I've come clippity-clopping into your little meetings in, like, these little mini-skirts. You could see all the way to Quebec if you looked close enough, for crying out loud. And I have these low-cut shirts and these hooker heels. I have that 1980s flash dance hair. I think they still wear it like that in parts of Pennsylvania. But I was like I was it, you guys. And I would clippity-clop all over the place and make noise and go get coffee and go pee and go outside and smoke. And you guys would be reading 12-something or others that I've memorized by now. I'm certain you guys are slow. And I would, like, get up and go talk to you during the 12 traditions because you don't need to hear those anyway. My sponsor put his hand on my leg and shoved me down into the chair one day. He goes, if you get out of that chair one more time during a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you better have piss dribbling down your leg. And I was like, oh, all the old timers are going, woo! I was so disruptive, you guys. I didn't know. Really, what he said was, sit down. But that's what I heard. I just didn't know how to do anything, you guys, and I got that sponsor. You guys tell me the men work with the men and the women work with the women and the men are going to pant your ass and the women are going to save it. So I asked this guy named Paul Matson to sponsor me. It's a little pat among friends. I loved that guy. He was the one person in that whole room that I was able to hear. He could raise his voice just loud enough that it drowned out the noise in my head. And he was the one person that I was willing to follow direction and take some advice from. And I started doing things that I thought were ridiculous. I started showing up early and staying late and dressing appropriately. I was at that old-timers meeting dressed like a hooker, for lack of a better term. And he told me that I needed to go change my clothes. And you guys, I've never had a man tell me to go put more clothes on in my whole life. Like, I didn't know what to do with that, and I didn't want to go change my clothes. I looked cute, and I was getting the attention that I thought like I deserved in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Paul didn't allow me to ask questions and say, how come I got to do that? I just had to do what he told me to, and then if I didn't know later, he would explain it to me. And I went, I stomped out of the room, I went and put some more clothes on, I came back, and I hung out at that meeting, and my life started to change, you guys. I had no idea by taking that action, he was teaching me a little bit of dignity, a little bit of self-respect, a way to carry myself. I had no idea a couple weeks later that I was going to walk into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and you men and women were going to look me in my face and I was going to be able to meet your gaze. I didn't know, like, that was the result that I was going to be able to get from taking that action. But that's what happened to me, and that's the way that he taught me how to do things. He walked right along with me, gave me actions to take, which changed my perception of life. And but I was hanging out at that meeting, and somebody got up to the podium, and they said one more time, if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any lengths to get it, and my little sarcastic brain went like, oxygen walkers and canes, oh my! Like, I don't want anything that you guys have. And as I was sitting there that night, I realized that 6 weeks sober, I wanted everything that you had. And if I'd have known that was going to happen before I went into that meeting, I would have left, you guys. I would have split. But I sat there and I realized I wanted it all. I wanted that sparkle that you guys had in your eyes. I looked at you guys and it looked like there were lights in your face, like your whole face lit up when you saw me. And I wanted that ease that you were able to breathe with. I felt like I hadn't taken a breath my entire life. And I wanted to be able to laugh the way that you guys did, where it like started right here in the core of your being and just rolled all the way up out of you. Like, I wanted everything that you had. And today what I know I wanted that I had no idea I wanted then was I wanted the ability to love you guys back the same way that you loved me, because it absolutely took my breath away. And like Frank was talking about, they didn't tell me, like, we're going to learn to love you so you can learn to love yourself. Like, I didn't get any of that. I got the sponsor because you guys told me to. I wanted to fit in and have one. And I would sit in meetings and I would get up to the podium and I'd say, my name's Tina Albert. No, I didn't say Albert. I'd say, my name's Tina and I'm an alcoholic. And he would go, that's all you know. Sit down now. And I would go like, oh my God. And I would crawl down the little three steps from the podium and go sit down. I got up to take my 30-day chip and I was going to tell you precisely what I had done so that you could get what I got. I was giving it away anyway. You didn't have to work for it. But I would... I was going to share because I was like young and I had young people's enthusiasm and like rehab stuff that you guys had been sober since the crust of the freaking earth cooled, that you needed this new information about Alcoholics Anonymous that I was going to lay on you when I had 30 days. And I go, I'm so great for these last 30 days. And he started doing the sponsor squiggle, which was where I learned to talk really fast because you never know when he's going to shut you up. So I started talking, and he goes, got up one more time, you're finished now. And all you old-timers were like, woo! And I learned to hate you guys really quickly. You guys taught me how to serve Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was a couple weeks sober, I became your ashtray putter-outer person. And I would show up 45 minutes early and put two ashtrays equally from the ends of the long table so that all of your osteoarthritic little arms could hit the ashtrays with your cigarettes. And I was the best ashtray putter-outer person in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then you made me your coffee cup washer. And when you were especially cantankerous to me, I would wash your ashtrays first. And then I would wash your ceramic coffee cups in the dirty water. And I only did that twice because he made me make amends from the podium, and I hate public humiliation. And then you made me your coffee maker. And you guys, I thought by now, certainly what you should do is make me like your GSR, where I could like publicly represent your meeting, or your treasurer, perhaps, which you did, and I stole your money, and then I had to give it back. It was just pathetic. But I was your coffee maker, and I would show up and make this rank Navy coffee so that you guys would promote me. And I would serve toothpicks with it so you could get the grinds out of your teeth. You'd like chew it and come up vibrating and go, good Navy coffee, baby girl. And you'd talk as fast as me. It was really funny to watch. And you guys just loved me, and you let me serve you. I remember I was a couple weeks sober, and what you did was you made me the secretary of your 2040 plus group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the big meeting in my Milano Club, and I took over from that cantankerous old-timer named Tom Woods. And you guys, you voted me in, and you gave me your meeting, and you trusted me with something that was precious to you. And I remember, like, I was running against old-timers, and then there's me, right? And I'm like, and they said, like, I won. And I remember thinking, like, me? Like, really me? I cannot believe the things that you guys trust me with in Alcoholics Anonymous. And sometimes in the back of my head, I still wonder how come. But I think it's just because what I've learned how to do from the time that I got sober was whenever you guys ask me to do something, my automatic response is yes. And I think that's a lost art in Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys. I was at a conference in Norman, Oklahoma, and I watched them ask 100 people to go pick up a speaker from the airport, and not one person would give of their time. It says in our big book that what we have to be is self-sacrificing. Like, when the thing that we love, the very thing that saves our life, like, we get rich, phenomenal, amazing lives in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, don't we? We get everything we ever dreamed possible for ourselves times 10. And then when we get so busy, the one thing that we want to cut out is the very thing that gave us that life in the first place. Like, all of a sudden, I don't have time. I'm, like, fellowshipping right here. What do you mean you want me to drive an hour and go to the airport and pick somebody up for crime? I don't know them. Why would I want to do that? Like, the one thing that's held me in good stead for 28 and a half years in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I have always been willing to tell you yes, even when I don't think I should, when it's inconvenient, when I go, like, Frank would do a way better job at what you're asking me to do. You guys ask me, and I tell you yes, and it's held me in good stead for a long, long time. If you're new in here, I hope you learn how to say yes to those kind of things. But I love this life that I've been given in Alcoholics Anonymous. I only have a couple more minutes, so I'm going to way fast forward. So I got married. I had children. I did everything that I wanted to do sober. I went to school. I had careers. I made a lot of money. I bought houses. I traded new cars. Like, I changed my underwear. I love buying a new car. If something doesn't feel right, I go buy a new car. It's a good thing. It's really not. But I built an amazing life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was married. I moved up north. I was married for 17 and a half years to, like, my Prince Charming. I woke up every single morning feeling like I was a princess in a fairy tale, and I had two amazing children that I loved more than life itself. And one of them, like I said, I gave to the Navy as my ninth step amends. And he was over in Iraq, and I was filled with, like, this dread that only the family of a service member might know, and I couldn't get a hold of my son, and I was so scared. And my husband, when he had 18 years sober, decided that the next step in his spiritual journey was to run off and join the Hell's Angels Motorcycle Club. And so he had an affair with the bartender at the local bar, and he rode off into the sunset with a bunch of greasy bikers. And I had my son in Iraq, and then my little guy, who's like the apple of my eye, he's my baby. He's the point guard, the varsity wrestler, the starting quarterback, the honor roll kid. He's like that guy in school that I hated, and he's handsome, and all the girls love him. I mean, he's popular, just an amazing young man. He started, like, drinking and getting loaded and quitting all the sports teams and cutting school. And I got two parts of my story coming to life right before my very eyes. I got a drunken Navy sailor son, and I got a dope fiend high school dropout kid. And I went about trying to fix my life. And over the course of, I was 21 and a half years sober, you guys. Over the course of 21 and a half years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had come to believe in a power greater than myself that I started to call God. And then in the big book in Bill's story, it talks about there had been a humble willingness. I wanted and needed God, and he came to me. And then it said that, and then he was blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly those within myself. And it had been like that forever, and how blind I had been. I come to this belief in this amazing father in Alcoholics Anonymous, like you guys gave me that belief. And then all of a sudden, like I said, it becomes incumbent upon me to turn my will and my life over to the care of that God, and then I start doubting that God. And throughout the course of 28 and a half years, I have, like, deep, effective spiritual experiences. And then 5 minutes later, I have an agnostic temperament. And, like, I battle that, you guys. I suppose that's why you put me Sunday, but it's really ridiculous to me, I swear to God. But I still battle that. Like, but I had two parts of the story come into life before my very eyes. And that alcoholic ego, like, reemerges. And when things are broken and you're, like, a strong, independent woman and you have this power and capability that God gave you, for crying out loud, why wouldn't you want to, like, use it? I went about fixing the things that I had broken in my life. And if I ever do that and you guys are within, like, a five-mile radius, you should run because stuff just shatters. Like, I broke everything that wasn't already broken. And I had 22, 23 years sober, I don't know, like, and I had destroyed everything that mattered to me in my life. In the big book, it talks about alcoholism. It says, with it goes the annihilation of all things worthwhile in life. And I looked up the word annihilate. It says to reduce to nothing. And I had reduced to nothing with double decades of sobriety, everything that mattered to me in my life. And I was full of self-pity, and I was full of resentment, and I didn't even realize, like, that was what was going on. In step 11 and the 12 and 12, it took me a year of, like, laying in the fetal position, like, I am not accepting this. This is unacceptable. And if this is what the God of Alcoholics Anonymous does when you serve him for 20 freaking years, like, who needs him anyway? And then I tried to fix my stuff, and I broke it all, and laying in the fetal position on the floor, reading the 12 and 12 in step 11, it says that sometimes the hand of God is heavy and unjust. And during these times, new lessons for living are learned and new resources of strength are uncovered. And it goes on to say that all of us at times are seized with a rebellion so sickening that we simply refuse to pray. And I turned my back on the loving God that I learned about in Alcoholics Anonymous and tried to fix my stuff, and I smashed it all. I called this cantankerous old dinosaur that lived in Los Angeles, and I told him, I am dying in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Will you help me? He goes, come to my office at 11:30 on Tuesday, kid. And I drove 400 miles from Northern California down to this nasty old mission on Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles. And I sat across the table from a guy that frickin' sobered up with Moses, and I told him, like, will you help me? Those are the most powerful words that we can ever utter in Alcoholics Anonymous. Will you help me? It's like Paul's prayer. It's my favorite one. I stole it from him a long time ago. He doesn't know this, but like Papa surprised me. That's what I say every morning, and thank you for that. Thank you for that. I heard a CD of his a long time ago. He was singing this stupid song called The Gift. I've Googled it all my life, and I can't find it anymore, and I lost the little CD. But, like, what a gift this is, you guys, this God that you guys have given me. And I sat across the table from Clancy, and I asked him to help me. And he started having me take actions that seemed, this is, like, so cliche, contrary to what I would think. Like, he started having me show up on a regular basis. And I was showing up Sometimes I would float into Alcoholics Anonymous. I love candlelight meetings because you would turn the lights off and I would glow in the dark. I was like the Clancine of the Central Valley, and I sponsored half of Northern California. I was pretty. And then everything was gone. And he started me taking these actions. He would make me take my sunglasses off in meetings. He would make me show up early, and he would make me stay late. I started driving, you guys. This is not willing to go to any lengths. It's 30 minutes past there. I would get up at 6:30 every Wednesday morning, and I would drive 400 miles to go have lunch with my sponsor. And I'd have lunch. I'd take a nap in the car, go to my Wednesday night home group, and I would drive all the way back to Hollister in Northern California. And I did that every Wednesday for almost a year. And I'm not saying you guys have to do that, so don't get scared. But here's what I know, like when my back is against the wall, I'm going to drink or I'm going to die. In the doctor's opinion in Alcoholics Anonymous, it says that men and women make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight. And we're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, the supreme sacrifice is to drink. And when we're old in Alcoholics Anonymous, the supreme sacrifice is to end our life. Because I don't know about you guys, but sometimes, like, I've made a commitment to never pick up another drink for the rest of my life, 24 hours at a time. But sometimes when stuff gets so real and I don't have an answer for it, I think, like, I was standing on a bridge at 21 and a half years sober thinking, this looks like the easier, softer way to me. Like, I cannot do this anymore. And I think we come into Alcoholics Anonymous and we surrender our alcoholism, our active drinking alcoholism, to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think sometime later, and for me it was at 21 and a half years sober, I hit a spiritual bottom and was willing to surrender the rest of everything to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got that sponsor. I drove down. I was going to my home group. I moved back down to Southern California. I left my kids up north because they were drinking and partying like maniacs. And it was the hardest thing I ever did. It was like my mom going, get out of my house. I left them and moved 400 miles away. And my little guy called me up one day and he goes, Mom, I'm like 6 months after I moved. He's strung out on coke, he's couch surfing, he's got no answers left, and he asked me if he could come home. And he came home on Mother's Day weekend. I put him in the car and took him up to Mountain High, which is a Pacific group conference that we have up in the mountains. And the young men in my group surrounded my son, and they showed him that he could have fun without doing coke and drinking and whatever. And I started taking him to the yard every Saturday. We go to Clancy's house and play softball and volleyball. And Dylan met Frank, and he decided that maybe he'd like to be a United States Marine. And about 15 months ago, he enlisted in the Marine Corps. They picked him out of Camp Pendleton infantry training and sent him to Washington, D.C. And he's stationed at the oldest Marine Corps barracks in the country. It's called 8th and I. It's right at our nation's capital. And he's part of the silent drill platoon, 24 guys that spin their rifles and travel all over the world and do these shows. And I'm so proud of my children. My oldest guy is suffering. He's an alcoholic, and he's got some really funky ideas about Alcoholics Anonymous. And he went through rehab and was discharged from the Navy just like me. And he told his counselor in there, don't tell me about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. My mom is the biggest big book thumper you've ever met. Like, she read me those stories in utero. They were my bedtime stories. I don't want to hear about your big book. And I am not joining my mom's AA. And here's what I know, you guys. I can't help my son. He's too close to me. As much as I want to, I couldn't help Dylan. I can't help Matt either. But I know this. The minute there is a little chink in that armor and there's a way to wedge something in there, I've got five guys on call that will be at my son in a hot minute to help my son. And here's my commitment, and I'm going to shut up because I've talked too long. Like, I got sober in 1984, and Alcoholics Anonymous was so alive and so vibrant and so clear on its singleness of purpose that you guys were able to save my life when I thought there was absolutely no hope for me. There's no price tag that you could put on that. And my commitment today, as it has been for a long, long time, is to make sure that one day when my baby needs to come into Alcoholics Anonymous, that the same alive and vibrant, clear-cut message of Alcoholics Anonymous is available for him. Like, that is so important, you guys. We don't harp about singleness of purpose because we're trying to be mean and want you to do things our way. Like, when Alcoholics Anonymous is gone, we're all gone. Like, I know that my life is amazing because I am right in the center of you guys. I'll tell you a story. When I had 13 years sober, I was still fighting this idea of God. And it was the night of my 13th birthday. I was on a cruise ship going down to Mexico. I was standing on the deck of the cruise ship, and I was talking to all of my old-timers who I love so incredibly. When you get sober at 20 with a bunch of people that are 132, they, like, die. And so I was standing on the deck of this cruise ship the night of my 13th birthday. It was Saturday night. I had just come from dinner at the captain's table. I was dressed in this lacy gown, and my hair was made up, and I had my makeup on, and I was so full of gratitude. I was standing on the deck, and I was talking to my old-timers, and I was telling them, you guys, whoever would have thought that I would have a life like this? Like, really, whoever would have thought? I was so full of gratitude. Just like they were all standing right next to me, I could hear them all say, we did, baby girl. And I know that my mama Helen looked at me, and she saw a mother. And I know that Paul Maxim looked at me and my broken, stinky, foul-mouthed self, and he saw a sober and dignified woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know Frank and Francie Priest looked at me and they saw a wife. You guys looked at me and you saw all of these amazing possibilities that I knew for a fact were not possible for a girl like me who had been in places like I had been in. And it's almost like you breathe those things into my very being, like absolutely everything that I am is a direct result of a possibility that you guys saw in me and then held me up to. I could never, ever repay you guys for the amazing life that you've given me in here. But I promise you this, I'll spend every single day for the rest of my life trying. Thanks for having me.